I'm Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe and ESPN.
I'm Christine Brennan of USA Today and Game Changers on Sirius XM Radio.
And I'm Mitch Albom of the Detroit Free Press, and welcome to this edition of the Sports Reporters Podcast. We do this every Monday and Friday. Yes, it is the podcast incarnation of the long-running TV show on ESPN with a occasionally rotating cast, and we're glad to have Chris Brennan joining us. And it's historic because, you know, Chris, you've got Ohio roots, and even though I don't think they were Cleveland roots, Toledo's close enough to be celebrating this morning because we begin with a story we haven't been able to report in nearly 2 years. The Cleveland Browns have a victory over, the New York Jets and the number one and the number three draft picks at quarterback. I don't know about you guys, but I actually, I was rooting. I never root for a Thursday night game, and I was actually rooting for the Cleveland Browns to get this done. Were you?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you're right. I grew up in Toledo, so it's 2 hours away, but that's close enough. And I remember the Browns' futility all through my childhood. And, you know, to think that they had not won a game, Mitch, since Obama was still president the last time they won a game back. It was Christmas Eve of 2016, and, of course, this was Christmas morning to actually win that game behind by two touchdowns to come back and beat the Jets. And as you said, you know, you're talking about the draft picks, and I think probably for the length of their career, Baker Mayfield and Sam Darnold will be compared the way we've seen class of 83, right, going back to Elway and Marino and everybody else. And so here it was, first shot out of the box for both of them, and Mayfield gets the better of it in a game that it just, the city of Cleveland's got to be over the moon, as they should be, and it's a fantastic story to start the season.
We've partially buried the lead already, though, folks. Not only did they win the game, they covered. So they made people all over America happy, I would think, in that regard. They could be 3-0. And there, but for a couple of errant kicks and just a few things here and there,
you're right.
They could be 3-0. But I mean, just saying that they were close. They had been knocking on that door, but the way it unfolded in such a dramatic fashion with Taylor going down and in comes Mayfield, the cavalry, reminiscent of a incident that happened involving that very same Jets team. This is 18 minus 17 years ago.
Yeah.
17 years ago when a linebacker named Mo Lewis hit Drew Bledsoe. And the rest, as they say, has been
never to be heard from again.
Lots of, do you know, by the way, here's a little subplot. Do you know that Mo Lewis's kid plays basketball for Harvard now? I don't know if you knew that.
You study history.
I thought that one for you.
I'm going to, well, first of all, Chris, you said it, you know, that Darnold and Mayfield sort of, you know, birthed together. But Darnold had two games under his belt. And, of course, I cautioned our team here after week one that the Detroit Lions will make anybody look good. And if Baker Mayfield was playing against the Lions, he would have had 400 yards instead of 200 yards. So Sam Darnold actually not only took this one on the chin, but I'm sure the New York media will let him have it, but he's taken a double whammy. He's kind of gone backwards from the first game, and he looks now like a rookie. And he looks like, you know, he made mistakes. Even when they were trying to come back towards the end, he just kind of bailed out and threw interceptions. And Mayfield, I got to say, I mean, this guy looks like he'd been playing for 6 months. He was making crisp throws. He was threading the ball. He was finding windows. He got rid of the ball really fast, which impressed me. And that's critical. That's a mistake that rookies make all the time when they come to the NFL, because the speed of the game is so much different, and they're kind of going the way that they used to in college. I got all the time in the world. I got a boom, you know, they're down on their back. Mm-hmm. And he got rid of it fast. He wasn't even threatened to be hit last night. Now, anytime a new quarterback comes out and there's no film on him, they always end up looking great first time around. And one of the reasons, you know, Darnold may be facing more difficulty is that now there's a body of work, albeit small, and they can look at it and they can start to analyze it and start to plot for him. But right now, between the two, did not Baker Mayfield look like he'd been playing a lot longer than Sam Darnold?
He sure did. And, of course, he's just he's a very exciting player. And, of course, the catch, too, the two-point conversion. So that's the stuff that makes it right to the highlight reels. And, you know, it's just fun for the fans. You know, we are all three of us are old enough to remember the days of someone like Don Shula taking his time with a young quarterback. And I was lucky enough to be down in Miami working for the Herald. And, Mitch, you were in South Florida as well at the time, watching Shula work his way into and Marino finally work his way into the starting lineup. I believe it was right at the end of his rookie year. And Shula talked almost every practice session that we were out there about, I'm going to take my time with him, and you don't rush this. And obviously Marino had the career he had in large part because of the coach he had, and that was Shula. Now, of course, there's no such thing as not rushing. And there's too much money. There's too much publicity. You're going to see these guys right off the bat. And I'm not arguing with that. It's the 2018 reality of the NFL. But you've just made the great point. You're going to see mistakes. You're going to see screw-ups. Look at the way Darnold's throwing away the ball supposedly into the, you know, out of bounds, and yet it's catchable. But of course, what a dangerous thing to be doing, because that's also could be an interception. So I think we're just going to see this manifestation of our impatient world saying, we want to see these guys now, and you're going to see a lot of mistakes because of that.
Yeah. Some guys are ruined because of that. I mean, you know, some guys never get over being rushed in and getting the snot kicked out of them. And then, you know, they're just gun shy the rest of their career. Yeah. There have been people who have been thrown in who never recovered. There were other ones like John Elway who suffered a rough start and managed to come back. Troy Aikman, you know, these guys were rushed into their seasons, and they had rough beginnings, but, you know, they rose. Other guys never get over it. In Cleveland's case, this was inevitable. I mean, they've been so bad for so long, and I kind of feel, I don't know if you guys do, maybe I'm too soft at my age, but I feel for the Ty Taylors of the world, you know, that you just know you're on your way out, and it's just a matter of time before they bench you. And, of course, he gets hurt, but they were likely to put him down in that game anyhow, you know, and it's always, like you say, well, Drew Bledsoe was a surprise, but there are other ones, because, you know, Brady was a sixth-round pick, but anytime you put a first-round draft pick on the bench and then you say, no, we're going to start, we're staying with our starter from last year, it's a death sentence, right? It's just like a ticking clock until the fans start booing or the coach gets impatient. And then, of course, the kid comes off the bench when they have a game like that. You really think, even though the Cleveland coach said, well, we'll look at the tape and we'll decide who our starter is going to be next week, is there a chance in hell that their starter is not Baker Mayfield?
Right. No, not at all. And let's take a moment to salute Baker Mayfield for his graciousness as well after the game and going out of his way to say that I don't want to get into the game this way. And I'm sorry that it had to happen this way, and that Tyrod Taylor is one of our captains, and I feel badly. And you know, and it's certainly a proper thing to say, but and it certainly had the ring of sincerity to it. So let's throw that in there,
too. Yeah, good for him. Now, I want to ask you, speaking of the Browns, and you mentioned correctly, Bob, that they could be 3-0, and one of those three could have been against the Pittsburgh Steelers in week one, a tie game. Now, for the Browns, that was a moral victory. It stopped their losing streak. But for the Steelers, it was a continuation and as well as a new beginning of frustration that when I look at them, I see a mess of a team. This is a proud franchise with a lot of star players. You know, when you have Le'Veon Bell and you have Ben Roethlisberger and you have Antonio Brown on the same team, that is a Irvin Smith Aikman kind of combination for our time. And they are 0-1-1. They're heading into play Tampa Bay, which is the surprise team of the year, without Winston and you know, the mania that's going on down there now. And I think that this is a Mike Tomlin issue. I think that this is a team that is in disarray. Antonio Brown just took the day off earlier in the week, just decided not to come in. And then when he came in, gave this crazy speech that was all over the place. It was a combination of you guys in the media and mea culpa for him. And you know, I'm here to win and we suck right now. And a bunch of this does not look like the Steelers teams of old who had it together and knew they were going to the playoffs at the beginning of the year. I think this is a franchise that's in trouble.
Well, one thing is, you mentioned those three guys, and they certainly are who they are. They're all on that one side of the ball, Mitch. I mean, they're scoring enough points. I think it's pretty evident that the technical, there's two things going on here. I do agree that there's something in the air that's wrong, that Tomlin has, I don't know if we go so far as to say, has lost control, lost the locker room, but it's not working in general terms. But the specifics are very clear that they have scored enough points to win games and their defense has been horrible. And as far as the Brown thing is concerned, we'll see how that plays out. But I just suspect he'll just step right in. You know, first of all, an interesting tidbit about this is that he has been targeted more than any player in the league. It's not a matter of they're ignoring him. So, I mean, it's not that. He can't say that. And but they're just not – it's the defense that's the technical problem. And, yes, there is an overall authority issue. How's that?
Yeah.
Well, and also – you know, we know that all teams do not get along. We know that every single team, right? We've covered, we've been around for the decades we three have been in the business. We know somebody's jealous, somebody's mad. Many times, though, that stays private. Many times, or there might be a little bubbling to the surface. But this has been so public, and I think that is part of the problem, and it's showing a team in shambles. Antonio Brown, as you said, Mitch, that crazy gaggle around his locker, and he didn't come to work, and the coach knew about it, and he's upset with the media and all this stuff. You know, this is, I mean, it's just the season's just beginning. So you've got that. Then, of course, Bell and his very public absence, and everyone knows about it. Everyone's talking about it. Of course, how could you not? The offensive linemen have been very public about that and how it detracts from the team. And then Roethlisberger talking about, is he going to retire? Obviously, he's going to retire sometime soon because he's been around for quite a while. And all of this affects everyone in the locker room. And I think Tomlin, sure, at the end of the day, the coach is always, especially a guy who's so accomplished and such a veteran coach, that it's on him. But you've got a lot going on in a very public way, in a public forum. And, you know, if they right now, you know, if they were to lose, their schedule doesn't necessarily get easier. Buccaneers, then they are at home against the Ravens. Then they've got the Falcons. And Brown's coming back if the Browns get on a roll. You know, this is going to be very interesting to see because very quickly they could be out of it if they don't win a couple games.
I don't want to put, you know, too fine a point on it, and you never want to pick against a franchise that's done as much as they have. But if they're 0-2-1 after three games, I don't think they're making the playoffs. I mean, I don't see that how it gets a lot better. And you're right, Chris. It started with Le'Veon Bell because this is a guy who averaged 4 yards a carry for them and had 1,300 yards last year. They gave him the ball 321 times. That's a huge chunk of their offense. And when you don't know if a guy's going to come back or not, it's like bringing two outfits to a party. You're not sure what you're supposed to wear. And when you have two, you don't have one, you know. And so are they a team that's just waiting for Le'Veon Bell so they can plug him in and run the ball? Or do they really have to reorient themselves and rely more on Roethlisberger, who is a diva of a different kind than Antonio Brown? All three of them are kind of divas, if you're really honest about it, all right? Le'Veon Bell is not making money. You know, that franchise tag gets a bad rap. I'm kind of like, I would be okay with the franchise tag. You know, I'm going to be the highest paid in my business. I'm usually all right with that. These guys make it seem like it's like being put in a box and put on a shelf and being totally ignored. I refuse to be the franchise player anymore. Roethlisberger isn't happy unless someone's talking about his legacy and should he retire and all the rest of it. And every other week it looks like he should. And then every other week it looks like he shouldn't. And Antonio Brown is cast right out of the mold of receivers as divas. Wide receivers in the NFL always kind of have this. It's not new. So you put the three of them together, and then Tomlin, who I just think he reminds me, Bob, of the old Chuck Daly, expression he used to tell anybody who was within earshot. After a while, they just stop listening to you. No. You know, and you know, I just think he's been there too long.
The other one that I love, we could do Chuck, but you're okay if they allow you to coach them.
Yeah.
That's another Chuckism. Here's the way I sum it all up. I think when you, however we get to it, here's what I think it is. I have analogized them. Was that a proper verb? All right. I draw this following analogy. I say they are the football equivalent, to go back to boxing, of the aging heavyweight, former champ, that still has a reputation and is an opponent, a capital O, that you set up your up-and-coming kid with. You know he's going to beat him, and it's going to look good on the resume, but it's not going to be as good as people think. They are that aging heavyweight. I think they are no longer a true contender, and that it always sounds good that you're beating Pittsburgh, but I don't think it's that big a deal anymore.
Yeah, and I think teams are going to be licking their chops to say, hey, let's get into the, you know, let's. There, here comes Pittsburgh, especially in disarray, as you said. So I don't disagree at all. This is a team that's aging and in trouble, and we all know it. And they're not hiding it. It's not a secret. And that means other teams, of course, are lying in wait to see what can possibly be happening and how they can take advantage of it.
All right, let's shift gears over to baseball. And last night here, I'm actually in New York doing the broadcast today, and here in New York on hallowed ground, the Boston Red Sox poured champagne. I can't believe that this is the first time, considering how often it's always just the Red Sox and Yankees. This is the first time the Red Sox have clinched against the Yankees. That's stunning.
Well, it is technically. Well, it is. Two years ago, it was a bizarre circumstance in which they lost a game and giving up in New York. And blew a lead and lost on a walk-off grand slam by Mark Teixeira, and then found out that due to the other game being played that they had won, and they had a muted celebration in the aftermath of having a horrendous loss in New York. This is a true celebration. Yeah, I just schedule quirk, Mitch, and also who among us, who on this planet Earth or in any other far-flung galaxy, thought at the beginning of the season that the American League East race would be over on the 20th of September,
yeah.
that anyone would clinch with 9 games to go. No one, no one, no one, no one. And so it just was no one. Now, what we thought 6-3 months ago, oh, boy, that last weekend, is that going to be great?
Yeah.
Well, it's going to have – let's get to it. It still has meaning to the Yankees.
To one team.
For sure, we think it's going to have great meaning, and as they're now, their quest now is very clear. They want to be playing the Oakland A's at home on Monday, on Tuesday the 2nd. I guess it's that today, right? Rather than in Oakland, period. End of story. And meanwhile, the Red Sox have to position themselves with a quirky pitching staff to set themselves up the way they want. And remember, here's another thing about the Red Sox. I'll just throw this out there. I'll stop babbling in a second. In addition to having 9 games left, before the season's over, they then will have a 5-day layover. 5 days after Sunday the 30th before they play again on Friday night. That ain't good.
And beware of that. The Detroit Tigers can tell you that story many times over, winning too quickly and sitting around and waiting for a series. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they don't play. The first game of the ALDS is Friday night, the 5th of October, 2 weeks from tonight. So they're going to have a 5-day gap. So anyway, they got issues in that regard. But meanwhile, the more pressing issue is the Yankees, and the Oakland A's. Who, by the way, had an interesting evening last night. 21 runs, 22 hits.
You know, I think it's first of all, Mitch, I remember that 2006 World Series. I think that's one of the last ones for the Tigers where they were so dominant, and then they sit around for a week, and then they lost in 5 games to the Cardinals. But I think, it's also good. And, Bob, this is, no one knows the Red Sox and talks the Red Sox as you do. But I'll throw this out there and see what you think. Right now the Red Sox are 104-49, which is remarkable. I mean, 680, bordering on 700. It's just extraordinary. I looked this up, and I'm sure you know this already. That 2 more wins, they will surpass the 1912 team. I don't think you covered that one, Bob. But
don't be so
they were 105-47. Well, I know, that's right. And, of course, the 1912 team, that's the year the Titanic sank.
Yeah.
So
Bob did cover that.
Yes, he was actually scheduled. Bob, we were scheduled to be on it. Anyway, the bottom line is this is unbelievable what we're seeing here. And the Red Sox have been, obviously had 04, 07, what, 13. They're a great team. And this has been, the Red Sox have probably been the baseball story of the century so far. But we're seeing something here that seems quite remarkable. I'm sure they're going to pass that 105 and get to 106 wins. So, Bob, I'll throw it out to you. Is this the greatest Red Sox team ever?
No. First of all, percentage-wise, they're going to have to win 113 games to top the 12 team because they were 105 they played 150 games that year. They didn't even play 152 games. They didn't even play the full 154 game schedule. Now, it's a very good team, but everything's circumstantial in terms of opponents and schedules and who's healthy when you play them and in any sport, anytime. It's a very nice team. It's funny, for a team that is going to win 100 and X games and however many it's going to be a whopping number, the most in their franchise history, there are such questions going into the playoffs with regard to the entire nature of their pitching, both the starting pitching and the bullpen. And there's an aura of uncertainty about it that said that they're far from prohibitive favorites. I'm sorry. I'll just stop here. The three starters that are going to go in games 1, 2, and 3 of the ALDS have a combined career record of 0 for lifetime in the playoffs of starting pitchers. Neither Sale nor Price nor Porcello has won a playoff game in previous starts. And so they have something to prove.
Well, I don't know about the 2012 team. the 1912 team. I wasn't there. But I would go back and look at the 1909 team and judge them, because consider what we're doing with the Red Sox here. In 2015, they're in last place. In 2014, they're in last place. And this is a cautionary tale and an interesting study in one team's approach to its front office and another. All right, and I happen to be on the other end of this. Dave Dombrowski is working in Detroit, puts together good roster after good roster. They don't deliver. Right around the time before he goes to the Red Sox, he's got Justin Verlander, Rick Porcello, Max Scherzer, and David Price on the same team. The same team. Okay, you've got three Cy Young Award winners there, or four, I don't know. And they don't win. And Mike Ilitch gets tired of it. There's some kind of thing in the front office that no one has ever really figured out. Disrespect or something like that, and they decide to sever ties with Dave Dombrowski. Now, that move at that time, it was like, well, all right, they've tired and they have all this talent and they haven't won, so you need to make a change. Where does Dave Dombrowski go? Mm-hmm. Goes to the Boston Red Sox. And what has he done since they finished back-to-back last place finishes in 14 and 15? He's got them now haven't they won 3 years in a row?
Yes.
Okay, they've won their division 3 years in a row. They are now set up with a young base of talent from Betts all the way across to go on for years, a rookie manager. They plucked the Tigers clean from everybody they could, from Price to Porcello to J.D. Martinez. Oh, yeah, he hasn't added a whole lot. And basically, you look back on it now where we sit in Detroit and go, what the hell were they thinking? What were they thinking getting rid of this guy? The Tigers have been miserable since. Miserable. Dombrowski has built an empire there that's set up for the future. One guy. One guy with one incident with the front office that they decide, we want to move on. And two teams' fortunes change so dramatically. You can probably find this story over and over again, if you really break it down. It just happens to be sitting right in front of us. And I think it says a whole lot about who you hire, when you hire them, and when you get rid of them in Major League Baseball.
Well, it's interesting. One thing, when you come to the Red Sox, one thing you have is resources. You've got financial resources.
Yeah, but they had money in Detroit, Bob.
Yeah, I'm
saying. They spend a lot of money in Detroit. They're spending it now. They're just not winning.
And what he did here is take a very nice farm system and use it as trading bait trading chips to help himself as well. And then, of course, made a major, major, major signing last year. With it's hard to exaggerate the scope of Martinez's importance when you simple pointing out what is the one major addition to the lineup,
right.
and it's him. It's a period. It's a simple. There have been a couple of adjunct moves that have been made this year, such as Steve Pierce, who has definitely helped, and Ian Kinsler, who is helping and continue to help. But the big difference in this team, one major difference in the lineup, is JD Martinez, who's having an MVP style year and having an MVP impact, and that's a signing. But you make a good point about Dombrowski. Everyone knows everywhere he's been able to do things. He did it in previous franchises. He's one of the great executives of our time, and they're very, very pleased to have him. Meanwhile, he's got his kind of a compadre, a sounding board buddy that was sitting next to him last night in the press box, and they went into the huggy huggy thing as soon as the game was over. Some guy named La Russa, so he's even part of the mix here. So they don't lack for baseball brain power.
Are you allowed to say huggy huggy when you're talking about Tony La Russa?
Are you kidding? He's a pet lover.
You know what, guys? Too interesting this weekend. I mean, we know now the Red Sox have made it. It's a question of how many wins they'll have, but they're in Cleveland, and I know we're not discounting the Indians as we move forward. This is a team that has been there. Talk about not winning the big one, but if Cleveland is having a little bit of a renaissance in sports, who knows? But you've got an interesting three-game series coming up. Chris Sale go against Trevor Bauer tonight, Friday night. You know, this is I'm not saying it's a preview of the championship series in the AL. I don't know, but to your point about the pitchers, Bob, Cleveland has got some guys that are also pitching well and playing well, and the Indians have been going to win that division for pretty much since April, May, and so we'll see. But I think that American League is really, really loaded. Those teams,
you're
Oakland,
right.
Who doesn't want to watch them play, right? And no one wants to face them, as you said. In some ways you do, but obviously they're a team that's been on a roll recently. And then Houston, and you've got Verlander and all of that. I think that AL postseason is going to be fascinating to watch, but I certainly would give the edge to the Red Sox.
I'm sure. For a team that's going to win 100 and however many games, the postseason is a minefield. It's littered with the mines for them. And you mentioned
totally.
Houston. I think, to me, Houston's a favorite, until proven otherwise. They can put out a better rotation, more reliable rotation right now than the Red Sox. Yes, they've had the bullpen issues and the closer issue, but they worked around it last year by using Morton the way they did, and they may work it around it again this year. They still have the lineup. They still have the pedigree. I still think, frankly, that to me they are the favorites, till proven otherwise. You're right about the Indians. Don't sleep on the Indians. If in fact the Yankees get in, you have to worry about that lineup. And if Oakland gets in, they got here for a reason. And they will not be easy. The Red Sox will have a very difficult road to get to the.
There are two sort of postseasons now coming up, and interestingly, with 9 or 10 games left in the season, we already know it. The first one is the Yankees against the Oakland A's. It's a one-game season, and we already know what's going to happen. You know, barring some total collapse by somebody, there all that's left to determine is who's flying which direction across the country, and it is across the country. You know, to get to either to the West Coast or the East Coast is going to be a one-game season, and somebody, one really good team, is going to be out of the playoffs. And while both of them are really good teams and they're going to have records very close to one another, it's going to be much more seismic if the Yankees are eliminated in a single game playoff than the A's, who nobody expected to be there and they didn't have the money and all the rest. But if the Yankees are now, the Yankees could end up winning, 96, 7, 8 games if they yep. went out and being eliminated in a single game and gone. And what happens to the New York? What's the approach in New York to that if their postseason is over with an 0-1 record?
Well, what could the approach be? And everyone knows that the capriciousness of this. First of all, that in any circumstance, there is no more inconsequential sampling in big terms of that in American sport than a baseball game, one baseball game, you know, any time, the worst team in baseball. And the 1962 Mets did win 40 games. They somehow they scratched out 40 games, you know, and so in terms of one game, when a pitcher, you get a hot pitcher, or, oh, my God, you know, no, it's completely, this is the ultimate crapshoot. The one-game playoff in baseball as opposed to any other sport, really, and the other three big sports we have. So it's if they lose it, what do you say? You'd have to do, if the Yankees were to lose that game, where do they go? What do you say? We didn't win. I don't know what else. I don't know what the ramifications
are. Well, except it's New York. So they're not just going to say, okay, we didn't win.
I mean, what town do you think this is? Don't go crazy. Look, the tab, I can't wait to see the post in the Daily News the next day. Yeah, okay, that's fine. But in reality, what change? They have to make wholesale radical change? Or I
don't know.
You know, the pitcher goes out and throws a three-hit shutout. It's great. If he, you know, goes out there and gets hit, you know, is down 5-0 if in the third, well, what are you going to do? I don't know.
Well, and I can hear all of our West Coast listeners right now saying, wait a minute, what are you talking about? Of course, we know what we're talking about. It's the Yankees, my God.
Right.
But Oakland right now has won 92 games, and the Yankees have won 93. And what a story the A's are coming on like this. Yeah. And so, you know, obviously the heartbreak would be there for the A's too, except as you guys said, no one expected this. And it's not New York, it's Oakland, it's the Bay Area. It's just a different mindset. But either way, to lose one of those two teams when, you know, over the NL, you got, you know, the Atlanta Braves limping home in the horrid NL East. And, you know, you think, wait a minute, what, life isn't fair. Somebody gets to play a full series, and these teams with these incredible records, both approaching 100 victories, probably won't get there, but still just in a season, and you're going to lose one of them, as you said, in the craziness, the vagaries of a one-game playoff.
And it'll spark the debate about, you know, what's the best way to go about it in the multi-tiered playoffs, and to go back to the way it was, eliminating the one-game playoff, which means there's less importance in the regular season. They decided they wanted to have more importance on winning the division, and they did it this way. I don't like it. All right, I'm sorry. I don't like it. I do not like the idea of the one-game playoff as a playoff. No, I'm opposed to it, and I hope that someday we can get rid of it.
Well, meanwhile, you know,
but it is. I was going to say it is great TV. You know, in terms of entertainment value, purists hate it, but it's great television, right?
Well, and that may be what they're after. But meanwhile, you got an entire National League that is yet to have a team win 90 games at this point in the season, and somebody's going into the playoffs with 80 something wins. And then on the American League side, you're going to lose teams that have 90 plus wins. The Dodgers, by the way, just before we move on to college football, a nod to the Dodgers. We were talking about them the last time we did the podcast, and they seem to have put, I mean, they're not home free, but they've put enough distance between them and Colorado that they're in control of their own destiny. And, you know, considering the Dodgers' problems all throughout the course of the year and injuries and how much money they spent and all the rest, you know, we're going to be seeing them in the postseason, and it's going to be a great story.
They truly took care of business when they had to against the Rockies, period. Yeah. And now, schedule-wise, they have one more home stand against San Diego, and then they end the season with on the road at Arizona and at San Francisco, if it matters. But I think they have put themselves in a dominant, commanding position. I think they're going to get the job done, and I think then they're going to be interesting. I agree. I'm glad to have them around. I'm 30th anniversary, but isn't it hard to believe they have not won? You just feel that they've been around enough, and they've won at least one more, stuck one in there somewhere, but they have not won since '88. I'm sure they feel it's way, way long overdue out there, and they are doing what you want to do right now. I think we all would agree they're playing their best baseball at the best, most propitious time.
Well, gentlemen, those of us in Washington would rather not be discussing the National League playoffs. Those Nationals I mean, is there, I'm sure you've discussed them in other podcasts, but the Washington Nationals, what a disastrous season for what should have been a great team. So I guess there'll be National League playoffs, but people in D.C. are just going to focus on something else.
Of course, that being the case, you mentioned the Nats. We got to go then to the big remaining question. Give me a gut on Mr. Harper.
Yeah, I don't think he stays. I mean, I'd love to see him stay. And, you know, he is must-see TV. You know, you can have a game on. I'm sure we all have games on, and you're walking around the house and doing other things. When Harper comes to bat, you stop what you're doing, and you watch that at bat. He's been great. I love the comments this week about the last homestand, and he's going to just take it all in. No idea what's coming next. And I think there's a chance they could bring him back, and I think that would be fine and good. He's been great for the city. People love him here. Good guy. You know, I've interviewed him. Couldn't be nicer. Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am. You know, that kind of stuff. So people love him. And I think they'd be thrilled if they bring it back. I also think, though, most observers here, most fans think he's probably gone. And you start over, and they've got a great nucleus of young players, Soto and others. So it's not like they can't keep going and be better. Of course, Scherzer is Scherzer. But I don't think this disappointment, it would be tough for Harper to leave with this being such a bad taste in everyone's mouth this season. But I'd expect him, my gut feeling is he's gone.
All right, now the important question before we get off the subject of Harper is Harper trying to look like Ryan Fitzpatrick, or is Ryan Fitzpatrick trying to look like Harper?
Or is that just how everybody's going to look from here on in sports?
Has anyone seen them in the same room at the same time?
I have a larger question for sports. Is shaving that difficult? I mean, we all know what athletes go through and what their schedules are in the day. Most professional athletes, if they practice at all, it's for an hour and a half, and then there's a lot of film. It seems to me that you could find time to shave, and yet you look at between LeBron James and Fitzpatrick and Harper and all these
Craig Kimbrell.
It used to be that the only time you saw beards like this was in hockey when the playoffs began, and that was a tradition. You don't shave until you lose or you win. Okay, I get that. Everybody gets hairy. But this is now like the look, and I don't mean to be gross, but am I the only one who wonders, like, you're sweating for a living. You really need like 6 inches of facial hair on you to get all soggy and full of sweat. That would be the last thing I would want if I was a professional athlete.
You don't want to rant from me on this except to say that I'm with you.
All right.
I'm with you
Safe
as well.
Safe enough. Okay, three non-beard people. Let's shift over to college football. Yep. Urban Meyer returns, and just in time. Because, you know, when you're taking on the Tulane Green Wave, you want to have all your people in place. You don't want to be missing anybody. And he returns with a 3-0 team, about the worst that you could say during the time that he was out, which he was allowed to basically be around during the week anyhow, so he just wasn't coaching
the
games. Is that he's now playing without a Bosa in his lineup for some time to come, and that's going to hurt because this kid was all over their defense. But you know, what do we make of his return? What do we make of the Buckeyes' strength? I look at their schedule, and they've got Penn State next week after they should blow through the Tulane. And that's a tough game because that's against Penn State in Penn State. Right. After that, they don't really have a tough game at all until they play Michigan State weeks down the road. And then they've got, you know, Michigan at home if you consider either one of those two things tough. So, Chris, Bob, I mean, Urban Meyer – by the time the season is over, is anybody even going to be talking about his suspension and what he did or didn't do?
Well, I'll yield the floor. Go ahead, Chris.
Oh, well, you know, I will. but we all have our things, right, that we talk about. I mean, he should have been fired. His behavior has been awful. The lying, the making up stories, the text messages all of a sudden disappear. Boy, if I have to be investigated, I want those Ohio State investigators to be the ones investigating me. Oh my God. And then Gene Smith, the AD, all his text messages are gone now. What in the world kind of investigation was that? But reality is reality. We're practical people. We're journalists, and he's back. So although he again this week leading up, it's a good thing that it is Tulane they're playing, because I don't think you have to worry too much about that, because again, the distractions that Meyer has caused himself and his team, Mitch and Bob, when you think about talking about the whole situation and how he handled it and the marital issues, he calls it marital issues. Mm-hmm. We're talking about domestic violence. I mean, he has made mistake after mistake. Every apology, every new statement seems to compound the problems. I'm shocked that Urban Meyer has not figured out how to speak about domestic violence and the horrors in the Smith family and all of the things that he helped contribute to, or at least failed to stop or see or do something about. That having been said, football is now front and center for Urban Meyer. And Ohio State fans have already forgotten, but we'll never look at Meyer the same way again. And you know, this the sanctimoniousness of Urban Meyer, the books, the I'm holier than thou, that's gone. And yeah, you could buy into it if you're an Ohio State fan, sure. But those of us who cover him and know about this and outside observers, again, Urban Meyer, I don't believe will ever be looked at in the same way again. And that is fitting and proper because of his behavior.
Hmm. Well. Not going to add much to that, except I was always suspicious of him. The Florida record, the rap sheet record of those players, 31, I believe, during his tenure. Just something about him. And look, we know he's a technically excellent coach. We know that he's the Avis to the Hertz, whatever way you want to look at it, of Saban. And we know that Ohio State is on the march to get back to the playoff. The schedule, as Mitch says, is there for them. They certainly got the talent. Bosa's a loss, but they still have a lot of horses in the barn, and they're going to be fine. And you're right, Chris. It's rearview history for him and for their fans. Are we shocked? If anyone had run the clock back, and somebody asked you, Christine Brennan, in the start of all this quote unquote investigation and suspension, will he still be around in week four? And I think your money would have been very heavily down. Of course, he will be.
There's this new book that Ian O'Connor has put out, which is not, it's about Bill Belichick, but it includes a reference to Urban Meyer warning teams not to draft Aaron Hernandez, who played for him, of course, at Florida. And he has him quoted as saying, look, this guy's a hell of a football player, but he effing lies to beat the system and teaches all our other guys to beat the system. With the marijuana stuff, we've never caught this guy, but we know he's doing it. Don't effing touch that guy. Now, this is one of his players who he has allowed to stay on his team despite all of these things that he's now telling an NFL scout. It's those kinds of things, Bob, that you're making this rev. There's something. And just as ironically, Meyer says, we can't catch the guy, but we know he's doing it.
Yeah.
Don't you kind of feel that that's sort of how people feel about Urban Meyer? That he's just been slippery enough to get, when he has been caught, he's wiggled away. Exactly what just happened here, case in point. Deleting text messages. I mean, in and of itself, you're in a university. You just have some kind of ethics system. Deleting his text message doesn't get caught for that. Internal investigation. Chris, you said, how do you survive that? Here's how you survive. You get an internal investigation. When it's the NCAA, they find every cheeseburger you ever bought for a kid, and they're ready to throw the book at you. But when it's an internal investigation, and you go get somebody who has some gravitas, from an attorney general office or this or that or the other thing, and yet somehow it always seems to come out that, we're going to get really harsh with the coach. We're going to show that we're independent-minded, and we're going to give him a three-game suspension in the weakest three games that we have on our schedule. There, that'll prove it to him. And once again, he just sort of wiggles away. And this is the body of his career, his football excellence is not questioned. But things follow him around in how he does things and gets things done. And whether it's this Hernandez thing or whether it's other players that he's had on his team or this domestic violence thing and the assistant coach follows him around, the whole thing was about, he hired the guy for the wrong reasons to begin with. And this sort of loyalty to Earl Bruce and not giving up on guys, it just speaks to a set of principles that he lives by or coaches by that are not always wholly aligned with doing the right thing. you know, on a societal basis or even on a school basis. And we do have to remind people that he does work for a public university. He does not work for a private NFL team. And yet he kind of acts like he does. And now I think they're going to cruise their way through. The Penn State game is going to be very interesting. But after that, I don't see Michigan State or Michigan being on the same field with them this year.
Oh, no, I think you could easily see Urban Meyer and Ohio State in the college football playoffs. And, you know, you're right, public, hey, I guess I pay a little bit. I own a home in suburbs of Toledo still, and so I'm a taxpayer in the state of Ohio. And you know, I don't see people lining up to march down to Columbus to demand their money back from their taxes for Ohio State. It's just not happening. And what amazed me about this whole thing, though, was where is the confidence of Ohio State? You are Ohio State. I'm not going to go to the Ohio State University, but that's who you are. You're telling me you can't dump Urban Meyer and find another person who can coach that team and also be good? Now, I get it. We've all covered sports a million years. I'm just saying, the lack of confidence of Ohio State's leadership to say, you know what, we're better than this. Get out of here. You're a phony baloney. Get out of here. You've embarrassed the heck out of us. And we're going to get some other fantastic coach to come in and coach this stocked team that should win the Big Ten anyway. And, you know, we didn't see it. Of course we didn't. But history will not judge this well. And Urban Meyer is a phony, and he's a great coach. And those are two things that are not mutually exclusive.
Mm-hmm. All right, last thing before we get to parting shots, just quickly, I don't know if you happen to see this story. And Magic Johnson, you know, NBA camps start on, I think, on Monday.
Yeah.
And Magic Johnson came out and said, Lonzo Ball has worked on his shot. And we all know that shot needed work because I think he shot like 30-something percent. And it's weird. It's a weird-looking shot. But he's worked on his shot, and he looks incredible, and he's put on muscle, and he's sat in the film room and blah, blah, blah. Am I the only one who's surprised that he's still with the team given the changes and given the LeBron James culture and given the fact that last I looked, he still has not divorced his father? And so, you know, that's still shadowing around there. I'm surprised that they're building him up.
A very simple question. Who wants him? What's the market for Lonzo Ball? I've wondered about that from the beginning. And because of it's a package deal, you know, and you're not getting just the kid. You're getting the old man, and no one wants any part of him. The kid is not good enough yet to be coveted. But the big technical question, I thought maybe that's where you might be going, is the fact of the matter that without the ball, he has no game, and LeBron will have the ball at least 75% of the time, regardless of who the alleged point guard is. And that's the technical thing. What function does he serve on this team? And B, who wants him? So, yeah, he certainly does need to improve that shot. I'll believe this when I see it, frankly, not as much respect as I have for Magic.
is he the guy who comes off the bench when LeBron needs a rest and plays point guard? Because, by the way, LeBron plays about 47 minutes a game, not a lot of a career for you.
No, help me out quick. I'm doing a brain cramp right now. They got another point guard as well. They got another guy with the ball. They got that. There's a more reliable player than Lonzo Ball. So the ball, I mean, I don't know where he fits in. It just fits at all. The only way he would have,
they got Rajon Rondo. They got Brandon
Rondo,
Ingram.
Thank you. They got Rondo. Yeah. I knew there was somebody I should know.
Yeah.
Rondo's no good without the ball.
You might remember him. Yeah.
Rondo's no good without the ball. Lonzo's no good without the ball. And LeBron's going to have the ball. Good luck to Luke Walton.
You know, Bob, I've got a question for you as someone you've covered the NBA and you know it inside and out. So there was sniping back and forth, of course, between the Ball, you know, family in general, the family Ball and LeBron and the dad and back and forth. Does any of that happen now, or is everybody happy? Do they all work it out? Do they ever go public now? Do you have any back and forth, say, between LeBron and the dad the way you did in the last year or so?
Chris, there's no precedent in the professional world. The LeVar Ball phenomenon is something that almost every youth coach in America and any sport can relate to, right? The helicopter, now we call them parents, but the overbearing know-it-all parent is a well-known commodity in American youth sport. It creeps into high school sometimes, and it even creeps into some colleges. But this has never before been an issue of any magnitude in the NBA or in any professional sport. So this is all new territory with LeVar Ball. Will he keep his mouth shut now that they got LeBron? I have no idea.
I don't think it's possible, Chris, to, you know, like sort of bury it. LeBron James is interviewed every 2 seconds of his life. And if somebody goes public with something like LeVar Ball, and remember, we're just talking about interviews. What about Twitter? You know, that's where all these battles are waged now. And LeBron James is hugely active on Twitter. And LeVar Ball and the Ball family are all over it, too. So maybe they've had a discussion and they've said to him, you know, the next time you open your mouth, we're going to look to move your son. And considering his other two sons are basically washed out now from NBA careers, it doesn't seem likely that he has a chance to even step on the stage unless it's for Lonzo's accomplishments. Maybe LeVar Ball's a different guy at this point. I sincerely doubt it. I don't think you change your stripes just like that overnight. And I do think there'll be some kind of confrontation here. But when I look at the Lakers roster, I've got it up in front of me. You know, we all know how great LeBron James is, and we all know how he elevates other guys on his team, unlike some superstars. You know, this is a guy who does pass the ball a lot. This is a guy who coaches out on the floor. But it's him, and then it's Kyle Kuzma. I mean, I'm trying to do like an order of who's the next best player on the team. I don't know, maybe Kuzma. Then Brandon Ingram. Then Lance Stevenson. I don't know. Rondo, who is, you know, hardly the Rondo of the old days. Michael Beasley, JaVale McGee. It just seems like, you know, a lot of guys thrown together. Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, the kid from Michigan, Mo Wagner. Does this sound like a team that even with LeBron James at the helm, that's going to win a lot of games?
I like a lot of those talents out of context. Yes, I do. I think it's going to be fascinating. Like, I was kidding about Luke Walton and the job cut out for him, but he really does have a job cut out for him and over and above who's going to who's handling the ball.
Especially being an assistant coach to LeBron James. That's going to be an interesting role for him.
We have to make an assumption that the James in his guise as a de facto general manager wants all these guys. And we know he recruited them all. We know he's responsible for Rondo, for Stevenson, for Caldwell Pope. You know, he wants these guys. So that's what's going to be. There's a lot of components there, actually. And mm-hmm. and I do like the potential of the rookies, by the way. They're going to be intriguing in that regard. If something can be put together, Mitch, see if it can be done. Because I think there's some, talent, tantalizing talent.
Set your DVRs for late at night throughout the season. All right, let's move on to our parting shots. And Chris, since we're glad to have you joining us, why don't you go first?
Well, thanks, Mitch. It might seem a bit too early to talk about the Olympics. I mean, they're nearly 2 years away, the 2020 Summer Games in Tokyo. But it's never too early to talk about the Russians and cheating and the adults in the room failing once again to protect athletes. As we expected and as we feared, the World Anti-Doping Agency, the world's drug police, allowed the most diabolical and massive state-sponsored doping machine this side of the old East German back into the good graces of the Olympic movement, even though they had not satisfied all of the conditions that were required for their return. There was no public apology, no giving over the evidence. For all we know, they still could be cheating. It would be as if the police held open the bank door for a group of robbers, said, go on in, take what you want. Or why not just give Lance Armstrong, Marion Jones, and Ben Johnson a big hug and welcome them back too. How bad have the Russians been? Well, one-third of their team was banned from Rio in 2016. They couldn't even call themselves Russia at the Winter Games in Pyeongchang 7 months ago. Not everyone in the Olympic movement is cheating. Hundreds, if not thousands, of athletes are clean. They're doing things the right way. We know the Russians are not those athletes, but now their cheating has been rewarded. Honesty, honor, and fair play have lost. The bad guys have won. The Olympic world should be in mourning today.
Bob.
Now, on the subject of, you ready for this? Tiger Woods. Hmm. Don't look for any remote consistency from me. He's back. He's not back. He's back. He's not back. He's teasing us again, this time with an opening round 65 at the Tour Championship, capped off by a 25-foot eagle putt on the 18th. By his own admission, this 65 was far more meaningful on the tough East Lake course than his opening round 62 last week at rain-soaked Aronimink. For the record, I have repeatedly declared that while he might win another tournament, he'll never win that elusive 15th major. Then I have repeatedly turned around and said, hey, why not? He's been in the mix at majors this year. Then again, he flops on Sunday. So what is he? A guy on the verge of winning a major or a high-level jag? You know, just another guy on the deepest field of excellent golfers we've ever known. It's easy to say he's just a colossal tease, but he could win a big one. Nah, not going to happen. See what I mean?
The phrase lambs going to the slaughter is a cliche, but it keeps coming to mind in Detroit this week as New England comes to town for Sunday night football. It would be bad enough if the Patriots came, period. The last time the Lions beat them was Thanksgiving Day of the year 2000. But making matters worse is that Matt Patricia is coaching the Lions. Patricia used to work for Bill Belichick. And you know how Bill Belichick's former assistants have fared. Eight have gone on to be head coaches. Only one, Al Groh, ever had a winning record one season at 9-7. And against their old coach, the former assistants win about once every four times. Something tells me Sunday may not be one of those times. Not that the Lions haven't tried to match the Patriots. We've taken Patricia, the former defensive coordinator. We've taken Bob Quinn, the former front office guy. We've taken LeGarrette Blount, the former Pats running back. And the Lions' record this year for all that? 0-2. About the only thing Patricia is leading now against his former boss is sloppy fashion sense. Belichick wears a loose sweatshirt. Patricia wears, well, I'm not sure what it is. It's this black sweatsuit kind of thing. Pencil in his ear, backward cap, and a beard out of a lumberjack story. So he wins the strangest sideline look. Sunday night, we'll see if he can win anything else. He's a Lion now, so why did Detroit fans feel so much like lambs? That's going to do it for today's Sports Reporters podcast. We do this every Friday and Monday, or Monday and Friday, and so we'll be back in just a couple of days. If you like what you heard, you can leave us a comment. If you don't, you can leave us a comment. You can tell your friends that they can find this podcast anywhere they find popular podcasts. And on behalf of Christine Brennan and Bob Ryan, this is Mitch Albom saying, have a terrific weekend.